Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hello and welcome back to the Sunday Podcast, presented by SportsShoes.com. I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Every Sunday we get together with a guest from the distance running world,
giving you an insight into the lives and training of some of the UK's best athletes and coaches.
You can listen to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and all major podcast streaming services.
You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Sunday Podcast, where we post about our past and present guests, host giveaways, and much more.
Thanks for tuning in. We hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome back, guys. An absolute belter of an episode for you guys today. I mean, I got to admit, I think the coach episodes are definitely my favourite to record, and hopefully you guys enjoy them too. Look, this week, Mark Rowland, we announced on Instagram, we've got a lot of people excited for this one. Olympic bronze medalist in 1988 in a steeplechase with a time of 8.07, now coach of the Oregon Track Club. We've had a few of his athletes on before, Jake Hayward, Will Paulson, so if you're interested in those episodes, check them out too. But look, just going to let Matt describe what we talked about in the ep and just enjoy it. It's a cracker.
Welcome back, everybody. Huge weekend of athletics. Obviously, pre-classic yesterday, and very fitting that we managed to convince Mark Rowland to get on the podcast, like Lum says. I mean, look, I'm not going to waffle on too much because you just want to get stuck in and listen to this. But if you're a fan of sort of dad jokes, one-liners, old-school language, Mark delivers on all of those fronts. He really is. I was chuckling my way through this podcast a little bit, but, you know, just got to thank him for coming on, really. Very humble, you know, a figure like himself in our sport. Really didn't have to come onto a podcast and chat through, but he did. And we're grateful for it, and we hope you are too. So many a lesson to be learned in this. Obviously, formidable athlete himself. We do talk about his early career in the steeplechase. And then obviously we go on to the Oregon Track Club, the Dynamics, Nike, the big brand, the monopoly of our sport. And then obviously, you know, his group as well, and the talent he's coached over the years. So it really is a special podcast for you. So take care, enjoy, get out for a good long run, and we'll catch you next week.
Mark, first off, just welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you on, and thank you very much. Do you mind just starting off with your own career as an athlete and kind of summing up your credentials on your own career?
Laughing already. I'm at that sort of age where I can't remember what I did yesterday and last. We're talking about 100 years ago, aren't we? So, oh wow, I know that someone said about it. I mean, yeah, what are we? I'm known as a steeplechaser. I don't know what you want to know. I'm known as a steeplechaser from 88 Olympics. Would have been classified as a failed 1500 meter runner, which I objected to tremendously. But we were born in that COVID era. And I did my training with Steve and people back in the old days. My apprenticeship was done through Steve back in the early 80s, I suppose. And you just keep moving up a distance until you find something. We're all failed 100 meter runners. So basically, I would have loved to have been the best 1500 meter runner in the world. I wasn't quick enough, I suppose. I suppose I could have run an half decent 800, but I wasn't. I didn't have what those guys had. And so the thought process was that I'm probably going to be a 5K athlete. Luckily in one way, unluckily in another. In that there's something in between that, but it meant going over pieces of timber and a 3,000 steeplechase. So I got I experimented with that probably at the back end of 86, probably even 87 would have been the first year that I did it. And I'd met Alan Storey. Hopefully I'm not bouncing around here. I'll get to the point. In 1985, we went on the England under 23 tour to China, and I met Alan Storey. And I was still going through sort of like transition. My coach, I was coached by Steve Ovett and Matt Patterson at the time down at Brighton Phoenix. Matt had moved on to Norway. I was doing bits and pieces, a little bit independent, doing my own thing. And I was needing someone. I'd met Alan in China, but back end of 86 or, you know, around that period, I sort of was doing some races up in Gateshead and didn't really know of anyone. Harry Wilson would have been coaching Steve at the time and that kind of ilk, but I didn't feel comfortable being with those type of people. But I thought I had a connection with Alan a little bit. And so I asked him to advise me with the view that I'd probably end up going at 5K. But him being up in the northeast of England, me being down in the south in Sussex, you know, I didn't know how that was going to work, but pretty independent, did me thing, and we just give it a wang. And it kind of made some form of transition to steeplechase in 87 and failed drastically, but thought I could be half decent at it and stuck with it. So getting to the answer to the point, I'm a steeplechaser from the 80s, and I'm a 1500 meter runner. It's pretty much it. I don't know what more you want from me. I think I won a UK title in 1985 at 15, but no, I ended up becoming known as a steeplechaser probably in 88, and then we get injured and you just fade away. So you don't retire, you can't run any faster. You get injured or you're mentally screwed up. And so you fade away into the background. And then that was the end of me probably from the early 90s.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually a great place for us to start, because you've touched upon the two things we really want to get into, one being the 1500 and one being the steeplechase, of course. Let's start with the 15. Do you really think all athletes are kind of failed 1500 runners who are not a 1500 runner, I guess.
No, failed 100 meter runners. No. Yeah.
No, not really. I think if you're going to be a failed 1500 meter runner, you're going to be a failed steeplechaser. You're going to be a failed 5000 meter runner. So I think if you're a failure at something, we all have genetic talent. I think if there's come another way, angle on this, I think there's genetics that you can't get away from, fast twitch fibers, and go down that physiological route. Let's keep things light hearted here. But I think you need genetic qualities. Where is that? You need to have attitude and application and want to work hard, and you need to be able to deal under pressure. So invariably, you get athletes that have two of the three, but very rarely do you get people that have three of those qualities, and those guys are normally the ones that are picking up gold medals and medals at major championships. So genetically, no, I kind of, you know, I allude to it. I didn't have that turn of pace, speed endurance factor down at the bottom end there. Even though I think I was reasonably quick, I just didn't. I run a 3:34, so I want no slouch. But a lot of that was done off of strength. And just bloody mindedness probably. But I when you train with someone like Ovett, turn of pace and you're around it. I spent a bit of time with Crammy as well. And you just don't have that skill set. And so, you know, invariably, like I said, you move up distance, you find an event that you're half decent at. And then if you're half decent at it, you start to enjoy it better. You know, that's the way of the world, isn't it? Tell me something. If you enjoy something, invariably you're going to be half decent at it or good at it.
Mate, and I don't think you've really done yourself much justice. You know, you got bronze in Seoul in 88. You ran 8:07, and it sounds like you picked it up. I didn't realize, you know, the short space of time you actually turned from a 1500 runner to a steeplechaser. That transition, I mean, I don't think I've really heard of that transition before. I mean, Jager first started out kind of an 8:20 in his first year, and we know the success he had. So, you know, why were you specifically able to transition so well to the steeplechase?
Well, it wasn't a successful transition. It was tough. It was hard for me, really. I think bloody mindless. It's that middle set attitude and application, I think. Now, I'd run, like I said, I'd run well in the 15, but you had this. People call it going out. I don't know whether I like that word and that term, but there was a lot of people. And I think there's a re-emergence of it now in UK. I think there's some wonderful talent in the middle distance ranks of female and male, and they got some depth there. And it was similar probably back then. And like I said, you had those guys. And I mean, you know, I'm running like 352 miles. And I mean, at that time, before I took on the steeplechase, I probably, my PB would have been 37, 38. So I wasn't, you know, by any stretch that great. But moving to the chase with the view of transition, and it coincided, there's a few things. And again, apologies. Like I said, it was a long time ago. So I probably haven't done my homework for you guys here. So it's a bit woolly. I felt that I was going to move. I met Alan in 85 in China, 86 as he had come back. It was at Northeast Abdominal Games, like I said, and I asked him to coach me. And I was running miles at that time and 1500s and getting GB bests. But you were another player, really. And so I always anticipate that I've got to make that transition. So Alan come on the scene, and I was coached by Kim McDonald, managed by Kim. So there's a connection there. And so there was have you ever tried the steeplechase? And they just laughed and thought, well, I'll be make the five. But he said, there's just a big jump from 15 up to 5K. And Oga always used to say, there's another 5 minutes worth of pain. And so I always had that thought process, but, you know, I thought that maybe I'd need to do something. Alan kind of come in, and I'd been very anaerobic and, you know, short recovery stuff with Steve and high intensity. And I wasn't running a lot of miles, but we were training bloody hard. But then Alan come on board and put a little bit more knowledge and sophistication into the program and sort of started to say, well, maybe, you know, have you thought of that? Maybe if you go over a hurdle and all of that sort of stuff. So it was a little bit, you know, I won't go into that. It's just a bit long-winded, but I experimented with it. It was okay. I struggled to go over the hurdles with two different legs, but left leg lead was fine. Water jump was appalling and horrific. And I just couldn't. Every time I went over it, my ankle just blew up, swelling and everything. And so I was of that type that I just needed to invest some time in it. I, at that moment in time, I moved to see a hurdles coach guy called John Miller down at Portsmouth. I used to go down to train at Pompey Track. And so I would go down and see John, who was a 400-meter hurdles coach. And I got introduced to him. And so I went down there to try and learn how to hurdle properly, really. At that time, hurdling was going all right, and I was pretty much weekly. I was going down on a Thursday night and then grilling quite extensively, which has actually transferred into my coaching philosophy a little bit to this day. Not in a specific way, but the stuff that you learn from back then, you do take forward. But the point was, we had the old big VCR stuff, you know, we've not got these iPhones and everything where you can do video camera. But back then, I need to figure it out. I need to just video it. And so I got someone to just tape me going over the water jump. And I, you know, and everyone's like, yeah, that looks fine. That was great. You know, there was nothing wrong with that. And I knew, in yourself, and you get the feeling that's like that. I ain't right. I'm not running, you know. I'm landing hard. I'm not doing something right. And so you invested some time in it, and I'll get to the point. Is basically I broke it down, and I took this BCR back and spent hours on the TV trying to stop and pause and doing this, always jumping forward a few couple of clips, but you never fully getting it. Anyway, finally found out that my foot placement wasn't. As I like it, and I'm not going to lecture to you here, but actually driving the instep into the barrier and rolling it and pushing off the front. I used to put my kind of foot on top and then push from the top of the water jump, the clearance, and then go up. And then obviously if you go up, you come down. So I wasn't really, I wasn't doing it right. And so I ended up investing time, learning what the proper technique was, looking at some other videos of people that did it half decently, and worked it out myself, really. So no one really coached me how to do it. Alan was very much, didn't want anything to do with steeplechase. He was up in the northeast, and it's like he would put all the training bits together. But I was always fairly independent, and so was there's this coach-athlete relationship. And so I was contributing quite a bit, pretty independent, as I said. And then linking in with John Miller doing my hurdles, and sort of like we started pulling bits and pieces together for the program, which would suit me. But the video bit come put on top of it, ended up working it out. And I think by within the space, very short period of time, once I figured it out and technically I wasn't doing it right, I kind of the switch flipped and I knew exactly what I was doing. And so I was, you know, your approach, your clearance, and the landing was so much more sufficient. And I was off and running then. And then, you know, I think I was gaining, you know, a second, half a second, whatever it was, out off of many people on the water jump by the time Sol had come around and by 88 had come about.
Mate, and then, yeah, obviously, yeah, it came around. This leads me on to my next bit. Are you surprised that no one's got near 807 since?
That's upsetting more than anything. Yeah, your boy, I'd love to see him doing. I think your boy's got some skills, brother. And it's tough. you know, when you look back, you've got to be physically robust and strong, mentally and physically. It's a tough event to get right. You know, it's multifaceted. It's a bit of a jack of all trades in that respect, isn't it? Just needs people with talent that can run well. You know, you've got to run an half decent 5K these days. The sport's changed from the days of old. Well, not changed, the event is still the same. It's very aerobic, but you've got to have that aerobic capacity to be able to sustain high speeds or high velocities under fatigue. Still, the basic principles apply. Now, you know, there's a multitude of different ways of doing that, and it's understanding that athletes with different physical characteristics can produce same results. That you see that within the sport now, whether it's 15 or a steeple, that people can train differently. Ovet and Co would probably come from different angles. And so, you know, you've just got to break it down, and what works for one individual is not necessarily going to work for someone else. So that was something that me and Alan kind of evolved probably then. And I, you know, you ask him, and we do laugh a little bit about it nowadays, once in a blue moon, if we ever do speak, and have a bit of a giggle of what we did. But it was all experimental in some ways, based on good theory. And certain things Alan had tried to get me to do, core workouts before steeplechase or hurdle training, I just used to come back to him and say, Alan, I can't do that. I'm swear. I said, I can't do that. I'm tired. You know, I can't do that. And then come back and I can't do the quality or the technical work effectively. And so we adapted and changed it around, and we played around with it. And so I was, you know, pretty influential in developing my program, but under the tutorship of Alan from that physiology background, really. And so we connected the two together a little bit. You know, I come down from the physical strengths technique, and he comes from very much the energy systems and the aerobic qualities, and sort of blended it together based upon what I was coming to the table with, which was very much a 15 background.
Mm. Having kind of been so influential in your own program, was coaching something that was always on the horizon for you?
I thought I'd coach football. My son, I thought I would walk away from the sport. I never ever. I suppose, you know, there's always reasons, little things, and sort of like sliding doors and things. But I would have been. I thought that I might have wanted to be a PE teacher when I was leaving school, that school area and stuff. But was never interested in the other subjects. But, you know, back in draconian days, you used to have another subject, and that never ever appealed to me. So I never went down that particular route. I'm a mechanic, technician by trade, which is very analytical. So I suppose all those little things kind of knitted together, working out, coming up with solutions, figuring out why a bloody engine don't work or why it didn't start. And so I do that now, but with people. And I have that quality, I suppose, if it is an attribute. I like that. I find it quite stressful, clearly, but as you get a bit more wisdom, you've gone through the process. But so, we pulled it together. But no, I thought I'd go back to my first passion of coaching football, really, rather than coaching track and field. And when you give your life to track, it's quite exhaustive. I left the sport for a couple of years when I was injured, and don't want to be one of these whinging athletes that always moans about their day and all that type of stuff and start preaching to the new breed coming through. So I didn't want to be one of those. So I kind of left the sport, but I got back involved as an athletics development officer and doing other stuff. So there were a couple of other things that happened around then. And I coached Hayley Tully, Hayley Parry, as she was at the time. And so I got asked to help her out, and that was a step into the coaching ranks for me, really, back in the end of the 90s. So there's all these little things, they're kind of like little things kind of knitted together. But no, I had no illusions to be into track and field coaching, that's for sure. Football, yeah, I would have loved to have done that.
But then somewhere along the way, you find yourself in a position now where you're one of the world's leading coaches in track and field. And you've got, the prize job, if you like, coaching the Oregon Track Club. So, how did you end up, in that role you're in today?
There always this path. I mean, like I said, it was fuzzy, say, that time of when, moving from steeple or interjection, and then after you get injured, and that was a big void, and that gets really dark with Achilles injuries and things of that mold. And again, all those areas of what, when you weren't able to run, that's been quite influential on taking that forward for my coaching, really. Mm-hmm. And what happened back then, we didn't have a support infrastructure, and you had operations, and you didn't have any medical people behind you. It was just hit and miss. And so a lot of people, had jobs, and you've got to earn a living. So you walk away from the sport and you try and earn a crust somewhere. But so that you go through those sort of areas. And I don't know, like I said, I got kind of sucked in back in for some strange reason, without getting into knowing exactly the main bit. Like I say, Hayley was possibly an influencing point. I didn't want to coach females, and that's not a secret thing, but I just thought, oh, that might be too damaging. I was coaching some young kids, English school levels, or helping out, and just done a little bit of that. Actually, I know when it happened. I got asked to do a clinic, a south of the Thames or Southern Counties coaching clinic, and just attend and help out with the coaches there. And it was at Broadbridge Heath in Horsham, where I was living. And so I went along and I had no interest in the coaching, but I was just there, and there was just a couple of kids, and I just sort of like helping them out. And then, I ended up sort of like meeting up with them on a Saturday, and then it just evolved from there, really. A couple of years back later, then Hayley, Ian Tully, was pole vaulter, but me and Ian, we were on the same, he was a young pole vaulter at the time when I was supposedly famous, and so I knew Ian and the pole vaulters trained out at Broadbridge Heath. And he said, look, I'm just about to get married to Hayley, she's in Wales, blah blah, she's going to come up every other week, can you have a word with her? And so that discussion led to another thing, and then I ended up getting more involved in helping her out, and so really that was the start of my coaching at the level, at an international level or more senior level. I was coaching the kids at English schools, but then dealing with Hayley kind of took me into that senior ranks. And she was at the crest of moving from 8 to 15. So I thought, oh, we'll give it a go. Let's give it 6 months and we'll see how it pans out. And within that 6 months, she ended up getting married. She ended up doing a 4K. But then that must have been about 98. But then 99 would have been the World Championships in Seville. And she just missed the final by about 100th or something like that, about 10. I thought, I can't do this. This is far too stressful for her. You know, but her and, you know, she burst into tears type of thing. And Tully said, no, he is going to carry on. And there was, I think, Alan had got dragged back into UK athletics at the time with Norman Brooke. And then they encouraged me to keep going. And so then I said, okay, we'll give it another 6 months. We'll see how next year goes. And so I continued with Hayley and was coaching some of the young lads down at Horsham. So rest is history. I think in around that time in 2000, the sport was in administration and it kind of changed. But then the World Class Performance Programme was in existence. And then the Potential Programme, where then they had its performance managers that were scattered around the country. And I got asked to apply for one of those, and I become London South performance manager at Crystal Palace in the southeast. And so that, you know, kind of did that. We weren't full-time coaching. We weren't getting paid as coaches. I was paid to manage athlete-coach relationships within all the other events. So that was a pretty stressful period of my development at that stage as well. But I was coaching down at Horsham with the likes of Hayley, who'd been coming down from Woking about once or twice a week. So, yeah, like I say, it just kind of evolved from there, but then got hooked into working for UK Athletics as a performance manager at the back end of 2000, 2001. And I think then 2005, 2006-ish, I think it was going where David Collins come on board, I become a senior performance coach. So then ended up doing once a day at St Mary's, where Zara Hypeters, who was the endurance manager, and Alan, who was the endurance manager, can't remember all the job titles, and I started across there to just spend once a week, and the rest of the time I was operating in and around the south of England within my other job.
That's quite interesting to hear, you know, how UK was set up back then and how it's, you know, a lot different now. I think there's no such thing as, regional performance managers, really.
Yeah. But, we had a big area, catchment area. And so most of my gig was spent with, not a major hub, is it, of middle distance runners in South London, Sussex and Kent type of thing, and the kids that were on the Potential program, they mainly were 16 to 21 year olds, but you'd have a couple of girls from pole vaulters that were maybe from Kent. You had sprinters, jumpers in inner city London, and so it was very much working with, you know, providing the science support and the structures, or try to, you know, to put the program or support the athlete and the coach. But it was quite a challenging time. There was a lot of stuff. Crystal Palace that was due to be knocked down at that time. And so we ended up trying to create a centre in Sutton. So there was a lot going on. And it was, you know, when I look back, and luckily I was young enough to be able to. So I was doing that. I was setting up regional squads. I was doing my job as a performance manager as my primary. And then I was trying to coach independently with a couple of athletes. And not too long, when Michael come on board around about 2002, I think, and he had been a potential in the South London West area and ended up making the transition and being coached by me. So then he would come to Horsham and link up as well. So there were there was so much going on. I mean, it was 100 mile an hour, really, and you know, that nearly put me in the grave back then. It was just too much. I was very exhausted. I would never want to do anything like that ever again.
Mm. Was it OTC that, I guess, came along and gave you that transition out of that into full-time coaching there?
Yeah, by that point, I'm a full-time at St Mary's from, I don't know, what year, I don't know what year, 2005-06 through to 2008. And so 2008, I would have been on the team, the Olympic team, to Beijing, and I got tapped up actually. So I met Vin, who was the president of OTCE, old coach that was moving over to New York, and he was there as well. And so while I was out in Beijing, I met with those guys down at in Beijing town, in one of the hotels. Loose conversation, really. Someone was looking for for an international summer, put a bit more international culture back into the OTC, which was a bit more stuck in its ways, very Americanized out of college, and try and push and just have someone a little bit more internationally renowned, doing something a little bit different. And so, you know, it evolved from there, really. And to the end of September 2008, I got offered the position. And so I had been offered a job somewhere else a couple of years back before then. And it was that was a struggle with UKA, where it just it didn't evolve how I would have ideally wanted it with me and Alan. And not that me and Alan, I just felt that the federation was not going where I felt it could go for middle and long distance. And there was a lot of changes there, whether it was Charles or whether it was Dave Collins, around about Dave Collins when he was there as well. So there was just a lot of changes going on, really. And it was just difficult. And so I got offered positions, and then this opportunity came my way, and it was too good an opportunity to miss, really. So always wanted to coach. I always thought I'd coach like Alan did abroad, just to become a better coach, be exposed in the different environments. And so my kids were off my hands, really, you know, and my wife, and just that English Springer was only about 6 months old at the time, but we said, sort of, let's go. I took my youngest daughter, who was 16 at the time, and so she went back into high school here. And so, yeah, I, you know, it was one of those things, really. It's sort of like, yeah, you just commit to it. It's my trade, you know, it's my job. So, you know, you try and go where the best opportunities lie for you to perfect your skill set. And I come out here.
Wow. So you've been in the job, almost 14 years. You talk about, you know, they kind of wanted someone, you know, internationalize it a little bit. And, you know, with that, recruitment is obviously a big thing for the Oregon Track Club. I think a lot of people are interested in, do you recruit yourself? Do people approach you? You know, how do athletes become a part of the Oregon Track Club? And, you know, do you kind of vet the athlete, if you like, and see if you actually want to work with them?
Well, this was going to be a nice, simple conversation. Nearly as difficult as the first back of my early career. It's complicated. We have three groups. Theoretically, it's simple because there's just an expectation that kids that go to college, right, first and foremost, my responsibility was the American system. So even though, you know, and I changed the infrastructure as well, and we were very much at the forefront, and now you see lots of groups, other shoe companies scattered around, but we were pretty much one of the first ones that I wanted to professionalize it and put the infrastructure, basically learn. Even though I said it was a bit critical of the federation, there's a lot of good stuff that was done of how athlete support, and I needed to get that sort of like science support, the structures in play. But when I come over here, really basic, you know, getting back down to the nuts and bolts, the old, not quite Harrier system, but it was really about running, training, getting on and doing the work. Whereas I think that in Britain at that time, we over-sophisticated everything. Everything was about your physio, this, that, you know, you're chiropodist and everything. And it's like getting away from the facts of you want to be a runner, you've got to run. And I love that basic bit. But so it's blending the two together. So I was always evolving, didn't want to come in. I inherited some good athletes, but, you know, I inherited 20-odd people, wow, which was far too many. And that was, you know, doing the culling was the first thing, you know, and that was tough. And so there was a lot of stuff that you'd have to do back then that, you know, was uncomfortable. And a lot of people that I'd warmed to, some athletes that I really enjoyed, that I just felt wasn't going to be part of that moving forward. And I'd inherited Nick Simmons from Gags, the job that I took over from, and your Lauren Fleshmans and others. But those were some of the bigger ones. And so it's convincing them, and sugar and spice, as you do with any new athlete that comes on board, is you've got to just tread carefully and sort of like make the transition slowly. So I always knew, you know, what I wanted to do. 15 was predominantly where I was successful in the UK and the athletes I worked, but then I'd had an 800 meter guy, and then all of a sudden I had people coming out of college and then done through Nike. So Nike sponsored, and so the only people that I can coach are going to get Nike contracts. It was different then, and we've gone through like three to four different Olympic cycles since, and it's evolved and changed, and the visions have changed since and matured, let's put it that. But back then, you know, you'd come to NCAAs, which are in June, and you look at the talent in America and say, which of the American talent do you want to pick up to try and create, to try and make teams, and then try and make championships? We had some foreigners. I bought Gemma Simpson and come, and she was just starting to go out with Tomo at the time, Chris Thompson. And so they came. And so it was kind of nice in that respect, because at least I had an athlete that knew how I operated. And hopefully with the technical aspects, you could, your older athletes or the ones that you get on or know you are able to make maybe educate some of the newer athletes or the people that you're starting to coach. Anyway, but it's very Americanized. So you're getting kids out of college. Who's the next talent? But predominantly Nike, who's NCAA champion? Who's the ones that are going to, you know, the top of the list? So you're chasing and looking to try and recruit the top people, really, and then encourage them to come to UG. So there's this different dynamic. We had then Alberto is coaching with projects, and then you've got Jerry as well as another group. So within Nike, which is to the day, you still have three different coaching setups. And so there wasn't a mass abundance of other shoe companies, I suppose, around. And so, you know, there was talent there. And all of a sudden, Sally Kipyego, who was pretty good, at Texas Tech, she was coming out of college in 2009 and was looking, and there weren't too many people interested. There was a lot of other girls, and because she was possibly Kenyan, not a lot of people to take her on, and Nike wanted me to say, well, would you take her on? And I was trying to steer a little bit further away or stay more on the 8:15, maybe the odd 5K, but not too much on there. But she was known at doing well at cross country, but I took that on board. So all of a sudden, my best, as it happened, my two best better athletes tended to be Simmons at 8 and then Sally at 5 and 10. But I had Bridget Franick I recruited, and she was a steeplechaser out of Michigan. Is it Michigan somewhere? Penn. She was at Penn. Lauren was damaged and broken, and I had to rehabilitate her back. And there was a few others around there at the time as well. And then Tyler Mulder, he was keen to come out because I had, you know, your shop window, you had people like Simmons who was on his game around that time. But the main point of coming back to OTC was people like Nick had never made a final in a major championship final. So that was my get me, people like me here to get these people into finals and start challenging. And so, hey, the rest around that time, the rest is kind of like a little bit of history. So see, that's how it evolved, really. So The recruitment was always done through Nike. I moved Nike keen on. They had a lot more, had a lot more people back then that they were sponsoring, far too many. And over time, that's just dwindled down, even to the extent now where it's actually, you know, there's small pickings, you know, their money is going to the philosophy as what I would have, you know, the elite. But the second and third tier is tougher to develop athletes now. You know, you don't get the same amount of time, and that money's not there as much. You know, there's been COVID, there's all these other sort of financial restrictions. So other shoe companies are coming in. So it's there's a multitude of different things here.
Mm. Yeah, you talk about, you know, being there to try and get someone like Simmons to make finals. And, you know, something you're quite renowned for, I think, in the running world is, you know, getting athletes to peak at the right time. And you seem to prioritize that over, you know, having an athlete who is consistent all year round, producing, you know, very good times, but maybe not getting that optimum peak.
That's very ambitious, isn't it? We develop athletes more in English. Oh, sorry. Apologies to the Irish. I'm a Welsh boy now. So British. It's very much we it's different. It's different culture. I mean, we take them on this long term, and it's hard to lose your spots. You know, I'm on borderline getting sacked all the time because people want your money. They the American basketball is 2-for-1, and it's the series is 7-3, and it's like I don't really give a toss whether you get beaten you know, people start at the start of the season, it's like, I don't really look too much of where they come, if they win or lose. How did they perform? You know, and you just know that there are people that are going to run well at certain times. And I learned that as an athlete. I used to, back in even 88, you know that, you know, if you've got championships at the back end of September, yeah, timing is critical. You know, you can end up picking far too early. So you've got to have, one, you've got to have confidence, and we make mistakes, you know, you live on the seat of your pants a lot of the time, but you've got to come with a plan. You've got to come in with a process, haven't you, of at least give yourself an opportunity to attempt to try and peak at certain times. You can only sustain a high peak for an extended period. But, you know, we have people that end up running well early, and so then you have to change the shape of how the year looks and revisit and go back to training, or, you know, train high, race low. We're in an age now where you have to have everything. You've got to run fast, and you've got to try and be tactically astute to make and win medals. So, you've got to run a time. So you've got to get a time. And a lot of people, where's those opportunities? And you've got to pick the races. And luckily, I had a kid that didn't make it into Olympics last year and was chasing and struggled, ended up getting ill, didn't make it. And so, you know, it kind of part of that education. But kids come out and he run the qualified first time out. Now it's like, oh, geez, I've never had anybody run that quick in April. But luckily, he's done it off the set. And so you rejig the process. It's like, okay, well, let's just take a step back, go back into training and cut the races off a little bit and then start preparing. Luckily, this year, everything's geared at June, that 23rd to 26th. So most of the national championships are around then. So that's a little bit easier from a planning perspective. Mm. But everybody's coming to the table with different stuff, you know. But peaking, you always want more. You always want more. Peaking-wise, it's difficult, man. You want people healthy and consistent as well. So I kind of look at it from a perspective. If I can get ad hoc training through to the back end of February and get people strong enough and robust enough and do a little bit of everything up to that point, then I'm preparing for the summer. You know, this year's a little earlier, so maybe I've got my timing wrong. I don't know. We'll wait and see on that. But people don't come to the table with an even keel. People have either mentally, like I said before, mentally or physically broken. And so you've got to massage that and work around it. So, you know, I've got a couple of athletes that are just starting their seasons now, and balancing the racing and the training is very difficult. But you have to be thick-skinned and just say, well, ignore the racing and just get on with the training sessions, and hopefully that you're not going to chink their armory and their mental sort of like capacity so that they can be strong enough to have the mental strength and tenacity to just accept it. So that's a tough call.
Mm. We've spoken to a couple of people on the pod before, and kind of they've all talked about also how individualized their training schedules are. And you mentioned kind of getting them through generalized training, I guess, till February time, and then getting into peaking. How different are the schedules between one, I guess, 1500 runner to another?
Well, 1500 is 1500, I suppose, in the end. You know, you'd be wonderful to be really sophisticated with the physiology. Maybe in the future, someone will come up with a device to say exactly what physical capabilities an athlete can be, i.e. are they a 1200 meter runner? Are they a 16? Are they a 1700? What's their ultimate physical shape? And then you can devise training sessions around that. I don't know, a bit of instinct comes in, maybe it's experience, but you know that the sport has changed a little bit now. You know, that with what the boys are doing is that we're gone are the days where you used to have to jog around the laps for 2.5-3 laps and then sprint like buggery at the end and then, you know, like the Hitler syndrome and make teams. Don't happen like that anymore. I think you need to be able to do that because you're trying to qualify. But everybody's trying to get into the same place at the same time. You know, there's a lot, the depth is so much deeper. Mm. And so you've got a lot of talented individuals that are very similar. And so they all know where they want to be and need to be, but whether they can be there or not, that's you know, sometimes the toss of a coin. But changing, I don't know, I think you have to have a process, I suppose, with the 15. Without getting specific, you can't, it's hard to get overly specific. You're trying to say, well, what races are they going to do to run the times? What's the nationals? You've got to come in the top three before you even think about the world championships. So realistically, you can't even think about world champs unless it's someone like a Nigel who's Botswana. And so he's not got a lot of depth in the country. Does a qualifying time, you know that he's going to be okay for July. Now, he's a different capability because, you know, he's bloody hot as hot potato. So there's a lot of other challenges with Nigel, and he comes with a massive history of injuries and stuff going on. But from a different 1500 meter types, there's a physiological, isn't there? There's physical characteristics and there's energy systems. There's just some basics there that you need to be aerobically strong enough to be able to be able to run your PB or three hard, solid races, you know, within a 5-6 day period. And so you've got to sit and talk with an athlete and figure out what makes them tick, and then you devise a program accordingly. I mean, I used to have, you know, I have had that, and I've had people say, oh, they're part of the training quad. I had three girls in 800, and they were on my 58 last year. Two of them trained together, and the other one's completely different. One's more 850. And if you're talking 800, you've got a 4-8 person, you've got an 800 person, and you've got an 815. So they're coming to the table with different qualities and attributes alongside their mental sort of like discrepancies as well. So you've got to play with all of the pieces, and then you talk to them. I talk to my athletes a lot, hopefully, and then try and sift out what I can. But I'm not sure whether I answered your question. I mean, what are you really trying to ask me there in the 15 sets question?
I guess not necessarily just the 15, but I think even just how you described how with the 800 girls that you had two of them who trained together and one didn't. I think that just says it all about it. It's not necessarily just about the event itself.
I scribble a lot. I used to have a yellow pad. I've now got an electric thing because I've got a scribble in my brain for an hour. I'm a paralysis by analysis, and so I just fries it. I have to go walk away from everybody. I think about athlete A, and I think about, then I write it down, I scribble on a sheet of what the next couple of weeks or the next month program is going to look like. You know, obviously, I do an annual plan and I work back from the major championships and work back as a philosophy. But fundamentally, you break it down into sections. And so what does the next 2 weeks look at, or where's the next race? And then you try and plot it. Then I look at another athlete. And if I can, one of my athletes, if I can section them together and train them together, it's better. Ideally, the Tuesday session, old Harrier system we used to have with Alan at Kingston, we used to have 800 meter runners up to 10K, and we'd have massive group training out at Kingston upon Thames on a Tuesday or at St Mary's or wherever. If you can get people to train in together, it's great. I try to do that if I can. The beauty is with my girls, their hard, intensive quality sessions, it kind of works out quite well with my 1500 guys, so I can always stick them on the back end. I had a group doing quite a hard session on Saturday, and there was a 1200 at the front end, but one of my girls, she didn't race, she'd been ill, talking about that, she was due to race, but she wasn't well, and so it's like, well, there's no point in you traveling, because I don't think that's wise, let's just take a step back and regroup. But session is, so we just stuck her on, so she joined in lap 1 and 3, so give her a minute recovery, so basically 2 400s of a short recovery, run off the back of the guys. And so you can manipulate and be creative. And so I like to do that. It doesn't always work out, but I try not to I won't ever compromise an athlete's program for the sake of someone else's. If it works, it works. But you will frequently see that I might have 6 athletes and there might be 4 different sessions on at the same time, or they'll be on the same day, but one might be 10 and the other will be 11, 15. So I can give them care and attention. But if they can be in the same environment and help each other out, that's great.
Mm. Yeah, and look, you talk about, you know, trying not to damage an athlete's confidence. You know, they need to have the confidence to go through races when maybe, you know, they're not quite in their peak. And, you know, what's more important at that top level, you know, the physical ability or the mentality?
The line of sense, it's got to be both, isn't it, really? But I mean, you've got to be realistic with athletes, haven't you? I mean, but you don't want to hold... our sport is about going on beyond your potential and going beyond your limits. Mm. That's the whole point. And so the last thing you want to do, it's going to be realistic, specific and challenging goal setting. If you give someone that's easy, then they're not going to be motivated. If you give someone too hard, then they're going to blow up. They're going to be demotivated. So it's trying to pick the right stuff. You probably add in a second or so. You want it to be achievable for an athlete. So you've got to set realistic targets there. People can train brilliantly, but until you see them race, you're not quite sure whether they're going to make that transition. And then you do have that. And I had that at the start of the season. And a couple of girls that thought were half decent, but run like a bag of shite, you know. And it's like, you know, that was a waste of time you going down there. And so you have to have an honest conversation. And I think I'm known for that a little bit. I'm not blunt. I'm not that horrible. I'm just trying to say, look, you know, what lessons have you learned? What mistakes were made? And you know, what can you do differently? What did you learn from it so that you can take it forward? You know, it's not my career. I've been here, done it. You know, I'm long enough in the tooth now where I've been through the process. But every situation is different. I'm aware I have empathy for them. But in the end, they've got to get, you know, I use the philosophy that I'm trying to create an environment that enables athletes to learn and think for themselves without the coach being around. That's really what I'm about. Now, I'm not going to leave them hung and dry. I'm going to try and give them some form of strategy and some logic to what I'm trying to do. But if I can teach them the why, if I can educate them better, then they're going to be a lot more mentally more robust and a lot more resistant. And they can then take that forward. And that can give them the confidence to hopefully then make that transition and compete. Fundamentally, we train to race. And so, you know, too many people do it the other way around. I hear of everybody with these fantastic sessions and it's like, bloody hell, they should run pretty well. But, you know, you get found out, don't you? You know, there's no hiding place in track and field. I mean, you have your odd races and it's just been strong enough that sometimes it ain't going to work out for one reason or another. But it's like, well, you can't have need. You got to be a little bit more even keel as a coach, I think, you know, and it's that don't get too excited about the highs. Yeah, don't get me wrong. You know, you get when you get people like Nigel that can turn things on once in a blue moon. And so I give you, you know, hairs on the back of your head. You know, you're sort of like, that was pretty good. But you still got to transfer it, you know, and then do it when it matters. And that's still the biggest challenge.
Mm. Yeah, we spoke a bit about recruitment earlier. Is that something you look for then when you're kind of recruiting athletes now? Is it someone that has that mentality to go and do it?
Yeah, the more you know about someone, the better. I'm not the greatest recruiter. I just don't have the time. You know, I'm an all-in guy. I'm very much, you know, I do tell people that it's look, if you're here with me, you get your 100%. I'm fully focused on trying to enable. It doesn't matter what stand you are as well. It's like, look, let's try and maximize and get optimal performance for this individual. Mm-hmm. I'm in, you know, I'll meet an athlete toe to toe and match it, you know. But recruiting wise, you're not really certain about anyone until you get them, you know, in your environment, really, and see what their capabilities. If you can find that out a little bit more and try and develop that, like I said, America's a bit of a hotbed, really. I mean, it's ruthless out here. And so you don't always have the opportunity. People go and get the agent first before they get the coach, which I just can't buy into. I can't deal with it. I struggle with that. And like, well, just... you know, surely just figure out which environment you want, which is going to be the best coach for you, and then the rest of it will take care of itself. But that's just the way the culture is here. So, yeah, be accepting of it. So you are presented the recruitment. You do want to try and have a conversation with people. And you can find out quickly, I think, even sometimes within a few meetings. But you do hear a lot of people talk a bloody good game, don't they? And there are a lot of people that are a little bit more, you know, humble and maybe not as confident. So it works. There's a sort of a balance, a seesaw approach to it. But it's, ideally you'd want to know, try and that they're buying into the program, that they want to come. They want to come. And I'm lucky, I coach Spanner but Bide now, and he's not sponsored, you know, and he's come down from Canada. Like I said, people come when they're mentally or physically broken and not bit more experience, but he wants to be here, and it's like, oh, that's fantastic, you know, that's a lot of damage, and so you're rebooting and restarting and having to get some basic stuff done. You've got to compromise certain aspects of the program, and you know you're looking a little bit further down. I mean, I had that with Pat Tin, and I thought Pat was going to be here until the next Olympics, and then Nike didn't sign in for a contract, and so he's moved to Puma. And it's like devastating, you know. It's like, well, we just started the process, and you just get the rug pulled from underneath your feet, and it's so demoralizing, you know. That's what it's in. It's the same as being a football manager, isn't it?
Yeah.
Your best, you know, Declan Rice, is he going to stay at West Ham? You know, all of a sudden, he goes to a big club, and someone's pulled the rug from under West Ham's, and there's his best player that's gone, and they got to fill a gap, you know. So it's. It's the same as being a football manager, I suppose. It's professional sport. So, yeah, I've got to suck it up and get on with it.
Just produce the next talent. Yeah, I mean, me as a fan's got to ask this question, really, just a big fan of the sport. You know, like you say, you've name-dropped a few people there. Amos, you know, us Brits, we love Jake Hayward as well. Can you pick, you know, is there one person who sort of stands out and you think, geez, you know, this person's an absolute super talent. Like, you know, it's a pleasure to kind of work with them. It's probably a hard question for you to answer, but
I can't answer that too much because there's always pros and cons, and it's unfair. I wouldn't expose any of my athletes out in public, like what dirty washing, all that sort of stuff. undo that. What's said behind the closed door stays behind. But you know, but using someone like Nigel, I mean, Nigel come in Rio, and I'd met Nigel at pre. In 2016, and he was after coming, he was looking to move. Met with him and his agent. Funny enough, it's pre-Fontaine weekend now, so this was, oh, blimey, five, six years ago. And so he was damaged. And they say, like, well, you get 1 year out, 1 year back, 2 year out, 2 year back, 3 years out, probably forget it. And Nigel had been out pretty much 2.5, 3 years, and it's like, yeah, talent, but. There's so much, you know, and again, coming to that college thing with the Americans, is a lot of the kids develop early. And so you can get away with it when you sort of break someone that's 16 to 20. But once you get beyond that, then, you know, you've already maxed capacities, you've already done big boy training, and you're vulnerable. And so injuries occur, and a lot of them don't know why they, you know, Nigel run a 140, whatever, chasing Rhodesia. He didn't know what the hell he was doing. He was young, like, raw, talented, gifted, everything, you know, on a crest of the wave, add momentum, reasonably bulletproof at that age, you know, and it just goes with the flow. But then all of a sudden, all this, the world life happens, and trying to unearth that is not easy. And so trying to get a talent like that back is quite difficult. It is quite difficult. Yes, people say it's easy coaching talent. I disagree. It's actually, in some ways, it's harder just because of the expectation and everything. There's a lot more dynamic to it. But they're individuals in the end for me and someone like that. And even Jake, you know, Jake's come on board as a youngster, wanted to come. But you know, if I'd have said 18 months, 2 years ago, he ain't going to make it. He's too broken. I just thought, hey, make it. But hey, the kid's turned himself around last year and did phenomenally well last year. So now he got to try and back it up now, you know. So that's his challenge. And like I said, with the talent stream in Britain, hey, it's not going to be an easy task. But he's still raw. He's got stuff to go, you know. And he's doing well, and he's hungry. So he's got to shout.
You mentioned a few athletes who you described as being a bit broken. Have you become, I guess, known as someone who's good at being able to bring athletes back from a period of injuries?
I think I'm known for that, aren't I? Unfortunately. I don't want to use the football analogy. I don't want to be known as someone who's bloody stops people getting relegated. You know, I'd like that I can be in at the sharp end at the top. But again, you coach individuals and you try and develop them to a level, and you just have to chip away. You have to chip away at where they are. And it's the classic four questions of what's the performance requirements at elite level? What's the current condition of the athlete to elite level? What aspects of preparation need to be addressed and improved? And how does the athlete consistently perform? Those four questions fundamentally make up my program, and I'm always asking that in big style, once a year, twice a year, midterm review. Are they on course or not? And you always have to keep asking that. And then, but you've got to do building blocks. And Jake wouldn't have done a strength conditioning, wasn't part of my strength conditioning program last winter with my strength conditioning coach, because he needed to be with a physio and do rehabilitation, lower limb strength, and be in boots and chip away. And so you have to develop alternate aerobic stimuluses around, you know, ellipticos, biking or whatever, because you can't run. So you have to come up with a solution. But he will be different. Other people, Simmons and Hannah, as another girl, they swim. And so they would do swimming as after key track sessions on the same days as track sessions, so that their secondary aerobic unit is done in a swimming pool two or three times a week. So you just, like I said before, you've got to look at what they like and dislike and manipulate and manage a program. Gemma, you know, had career-ending injuries with ankles, but we did bike. And so I just stick her on a bike and go out mountain biking and just go up a steep hill and just ram up there for eight times. And but she liked that. You know, I'm not a great fan of the bike, but I've had athletes that quite like it. So you play around with it.
Yeah, interesting point, man. Look, I've got to ask you as well, you know, you've coached, you know, all across the middle distance and the 5Ks and stuff. And, you know, the one event you were specialized in, you haven't really coached anyone to it. Is there a reason for that? You know, have you tried to convince anyone to try the steeplechase?
Always try and convince someone to do steeplechase. I would love, yes and no. I have Alan Story on my shoulder who hated it, used to be physically sick watching me do steeplechase. And so I always have Alan on my shoulder thinking about it. But I've not won. There's circumstance. We talk about recruitment. I have had opportunities. I had a couple of decents. I had a girl that made Olympic final in London, which was a great achievement for me, for the talent that she was at. I had a guy that never thought would run under 8:20, run 8:19, and made world cross countries. So, you know, I've had okay success, but I've had the opportunity to coach a couple of our decent kids, but because of the nature of the squad, I've not wanted to be a jack of all trades in the, you know, that is something subtly different. And you want to have two or three maybe that can train together. It's not been the right timing of a couple of people that I could have taken on. And so it's not that I haven't wanted to, it's just that the people that I've already had on the squad has just meant that it's not been doable. And I've just never had the talent to be able to do it, have some, to be honest. I looked at Evan Jager the first time I come over, and I know that he was a talented high schooler and was setting all sorts of records and was at Wisconsin and was, and I know he was with Jerry before Jerry come out to Oregon. And so he never went to college, he just went straight with Jerry. And so he didn't have the damage of the collegiate system, I suppose. But I looked at him when he made 5K team, one of the first years I was here, and it's like, that boy's a steeplechaser. And it's like, no. And the rest was history, really. I mean, but he's talent, you know. He was one of the best American athletes, I think, that's been of a generation. So, you know, like I said before, he wasn't a failed athlete, was he? I mean, the kid can run 3:32 and he can do, what, low 13 minutes. So he's, you know, he's not a failed 1,500-meter runner. You know, he's a talented individual. So, you know, he's got to take that. He took that to steeplechase. But no, timing, really. A lot of it's been down to timing and just not having the opportunity to take someone. You know, it's not that I haven't wanted to, quite like to, but it's there's a subtle difference. You've got to spend the time. And I have done, I did that with Bridget, in that I would do pull them from the strength condition program and do a specific session as part of their S&C program and do a combo and do technical work with them. But that's, yeah, it depends on who I've got around.
Yeah, interesting point. And then obviously, you know, you've got the three groups, you know, at Nike. You have obviously the Bowman and the Union Track Club now. Do you as Oregon Track Club, do you see them at all? You know, is there any relationship there, or is it kind of just you have your thing and it's, you know, you don't really talk to Bowman?
There's a healthy respect, as there is with other people from other shoe companies, but we all have our own, you know, environments. We're in Eugene, they're in Portland. They're at headquarters Portland. We're in Eugene at this stage. Mm-hmm. But there's COVID's happened, Nike, there's a lot of changes. There's been a lot of stuff going on at Nike, and there's a new wave, really. There's this new cycle needs to exist. You know, watch this space. We'll wait and see. You know, they're coming out the other end. It's COVID has hit some of these companies, and Nike has not been... I've not missed that. And so they shut down. And so we have to reboot again. And so what that looks like moving forward is in process, you know? And so the reality is, you know, we've missed a year. We're not working in Olympic cycles as much at the minute. Before we know it, we're 2 years down from Paris. So there's going to be a short one. So, I mean, ideally, it can be done. You need a 2 to 3 year spell. I've got, you know, I think that can be done, but depending on how an athlete has come into the environment. But I think realistically, you know, vision wise, you have to look beyond and go into LA and 4 to 6 years in some ways. But we live in a quick fix society, don't we? And, you know, whether that's what Nike want to do, you know, that's down to them. They pay the bills. And so whatever they want has to go, and the rest of, we just have to suck it up. It's out of my pay grade. I'll deal with the athletes that I've got, and I'll try and do the best that I can with anybody that I have. I've got a couple that, you know, come into their end of their days. You know, I can't keep putting them in teams. We live in America and the depth is phenomenal. So, you know, their time's looming. So it's, you need to reinvest, but those guys are important cogs in my program for the likes of Jake, Will, and the younger, anybody new that I have, because they just create that understanding of what my expectations are, what the expectations and the roles and responsibilities as an elite athlete, and how to do it. You know, if you can get athletes that are more senior, they can do the job for you, and that's, you know, I think an important component. Hopefully, you know, I'd always want to be able to have that, but hey, luckily, like I said, when I come out, I was winging it a little, and very grateful that Gemma came with me in some ways, you know. So I was lucky in that respect.
100%. It's interesting you're talking about kind of the whole group as a whole and how they react together as a team, I guess. Where do you see kind of your own future and the future of the group over the next 5 years? You did mention the Olympic cycles.
Hey, it's up for grabs now. I don't know, if I'm honest. You know, I've committed through to Eugene and then watch this space, really. I don't know what the future are. You know, I don't really... The problem is I don't like thinking like that because I don't want to be distracted from my job. And in the end, as a coach, irrelevant of what you are, if you are a good coach, I like to believe that I'm half decent, you've got to be trustworthy, and you have to put the needs of your athletes before your own aspirations and goals and the task at hand. And so my task at hand is, look, I've got a couple of broken athletes and I'm tiptoeing some. Couple of them are rolling quite nicely, you know, and you're always going to have the process of a third. but you know, I'm in it. You know, this is the we're May, end of May now, and it's critical, you know, critical stages, and so I don't want to drop the ball for any of my guys. You know, whether I've got a girl that run a PB of 4:10, fantastic. She ain't going to make a team. You know, she probably may not make US championships, but I feel responsible, you know, in that I want to get her down to 4:08, 4:06, 4:08 if I can, and at least give her that process of and trying to develop her to the best of my ability. And well, others, you know, you got people, I've got a few that have already qualified. And so I have to start thinking about July for them, but, you know, seeing where the race program fits. So I'm on that role now. I've just got to keep it. Luckily enough, the competitions are kind of fixed in the next month leading into nationals. But I may have to make some adjustments depending on how someone performs, you know, whether it be a pre or whether it be in Portland on the 11th of June. But the reality is I'm 2 weeks out then and it's like, hey, nearly too late. Yeah, it's never too late. But I mean, I'm not going to have a lot of competitions there. I'm going to have to box cleverly if things aren't going great at that point.
Look, we've spoke about, you've touched upon it there, the competition's coming up, Eugene this summer. It's obviously pre-weekend as well. And look, us being British, we obviously watch the Diamond League on the TV and stuff, but, you know, not many people get to experience pre-weekend. You literally live around the corner. So, you know, what is the pre-classic like, you know, as a race, as a spectacle? Is it the best meet in the world?
It's exhausting for me on my doorstep. From the demands of Nike. And so I'm having people from Nike about pacemaking and stuff. And it was a lot more stressful back in the old days when there was an expectation. Now I'm a little bit more thick-skinned. Well, I wouldn't have been there, but I mean, thick-skinned in saying no. Not having an athlete pace. So that challenge still exists. And so, you know, you want to do the right things and stuff. But as far as it's fantastic. I mean, you know, there are places in the US, but it is the place in America where it's as close as you can get to the old Crystal Palace or somewhere like that, you know, and the old Coca-Cola meets and, you know, the Diamond Leagues or whatever they want to call them now. But, you know, London, in Europe, there are certain locations where you just, as an educated audience, loves track and field, and it's full, and the atmosphere is great. That's the same here. It is very pleasant in that respect. It's TV rights as such that it's generally a little bit earlier. There'll be good meets. There could be good events on the Friday night. I actually quite like the Friday night meet because it's better conditions. We've got a new track here now, which I've not really been in that much just because of COVID and college restrictions. And so, you know, I've not been in there very much. But the track and the surrounding is beautiful. And you get, you know, for pros and cons with Nike is, hey, part of their contract is they've got to turn up. And so you're going to get a quality of field here. It's, there's going to be some tremendous performances. And but it's the start of the game. You know, you can't lead so much into it. We know who the big hitters are a lot of the time. Some of these guys are going to come out because of Nike contracts, but a lot of them are using it as part of as a mechanism. So, that, you know, a lot of people from other countries are probably just thinking July, middle of July. So we're still 6 weeks, two months down the line for the top dogs, and so they'll take it with a pinch of salt. They'll want to perform well to the best of their abilities, as any elite athlete does. But you know, they'll still be thinking, you know, what am I doing in the middle of July? You know, I want gold medal, you know, and so everything will be geared towards that.
And obviously, world champs again is Eugene. Does that, I guess, make it a bit more special for OTC athletes being just around the corner?
Ideally, I would love to have more of them doing it. Like I said, you know, I would like more. I'd like more that would be competing. You know, hopefully we should have some form of representation. I'm pretty much there. Got one guy that was an 800 lad that I think needs to qualify at the beginning of June, you know, and hopefully does that. But then, you know, everybody has to perform in their national champs. So, you know, I'll have three or four possibly, hopefully, competing. So at least there's something going on. But yeah, I mean, yeah, it's ruthless, isn't it? You know, it's a long way to go before that point. I'm not really thinking so much. I mean, it's in the back of mind and it's part of my plans. But you know, like I said, you can't run it unless you qualify. And you know, a lot of the, I think the Canadians are one past the system, the Brits two past, America, hey, shit, it's the fan there, three in and you know, and that's that. But I don't have too many Americans that are going to make it. I don't have enough people that are, I've got outside bets, but I don't have anybody that I feel is got a strong opportunity to qualify. I don't have those athletes, you know, for one reason or another. So that's my point. My biggest challenge is to try and get new talent, really.
Looking back at the past then, maybe obviously you had, we've mentioned Nick Simmons a fair bit on the pod today, and he was someone who was ridiculously good at qualifying through that US three past the post system. What was it about him and I guess your relationship with him that made him so good at qualifying for major championships?
Nick was very good at mentally and physically peaking. You mentioned that earlier. Whether there is some science to that or not, I don't know. And obviously, the people more sophisticated can come up with that. But he, in his mind, he felt he only had that energy to do it at certain periods. And so there was always this methodical process of making sure that he would go back. And there was a couple, and I suppose in 2013, we were bold enough to say, well, we're confident enough we can possibly make the team and we'll go for the Worlds. And which was, you know, at that time was about, I think it was a good period, about 6 weeks after. So it was like, look, borderline. But he was always a more strength athlete anyway. So more 15, wanted to run a good 15. And so that was a little bit more conducive for someone like him. And the three rounds, so mentally he was very good. Nick's very, if you could get him on the line believing that he had a shout, then you knew that there was always going to be a pretty good chance that he'd make a team or compete well. So that was really where Nick's strengths lie, I think. And yeah, perfect for me. You know, I was pretty blunt and ruthless with him at times. Certain stages, and he was always good. He'd always buy in. He said, look, if you want me to do, you know, and I know that no more is a bit more marking, which isn't right, really my cloth, but he said, look, I'll pack it in and tell him. I said, no, certain times I need to pull you in and I'll let you know. And so we had a very honest relationship, and I think the better ones, the top ones, you have to have that. You have to get underneath their skin to see what makes them tick. And they need to buy into it. And it's you know, they've got to believe that you're the best coach out there, even though you might not be. They've got to think that you are. And if you have that, then you've got to shout, you know, because they're bought in. The chemistry is possibly there. It has to be there, really. And then, you know, they're buying into the program. And the program is, like I said, multifaceted. It don't always have to be the right thing, you know. We are living in an age now where it needs to be a little bit more, you know, a bit more sophisticated, etc. But, you know, if you believe it to be right, then that can outweigh what's written on paper.
Yeah, I think you're bang on there, mate. Look, cautious of the time and stuff, but just finishing up, any predictions for this weekend then? Are we going to see a quick mile go down? Are we going to see, you know, sub 3:48 clock in? Any predictions on the winner as well?
I suppose all the it's how I'm lacking and how I'm unprofessional and not a very good coach. I don't know what the field. I know that the fields are good, and so my athlete, I've got two in a Bowman, mm-hmm. which is kind of pleasant, and that's great for them, but they're not the expected. To challenge, I don't suppose Timothy got Ingebrigtsen's, the usual players. I just want them to go in and compete and learn and be amongst it and be in there challenging and not be frightened, have some courage and go and get involved. And that'd be great for me. Whatever happens, happens. The top ones are never too far away, are they? Like I said, their belief systems are there. Unfortunately, we don't have an 800, which is disappointing for me. I'd quite like to have had, saying that Nigel stuck in South Africa, we still struggle. So I'm doing what I said I don't do, what I don't like doing is long distance coaching. But I know well enough that we're just tiptoeing our way through until he does a couple of races and then bring him over in the build for the world. So that's not perfect. So hopefully he don't get broken too much and then we can do what we can do. But no, that would have been nice for a couple of my guys to have been in an eight as well. But there's going to be great competition, isn't there? I think, you know, there's always world record attempts. Not sure what I make of that on some of them. Sometimes the pacemakers, they ask for times. And this is the challenge, you know, be careful what I say, but, you know, with agents, managers and other people, is they start asking for stupid times and pacing. And it's like, are the athletes really up for it? You know, that's more to the point. And some of them are. And we'll see. But, yeah, look. The depth is the talent's there, isn't there? I mean, the 5K could go down. That'd be an interesting one. And the Bowman's going to be competitive. Like I said, there's a great field, so it's going to be a great race.
Yeah. Well, look, Mark, it's been great to chat to you today. We'll let you get on with the rest of your day. But thanks so much for coming on the podcast.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.